This is The Guardian. I'm Jane Lee, coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and this is the full story newsroom edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. Labor went to the last federal election with a plan to reform political donation rules. But this week, the crossbench joined forces to propose their own bill. It's the latest in a long and slow-moving line of reforms proposed over the years.
I don't think it is tenable at all to have the sort of dollars washing around the system such as occurs in the United States. I think that is unhealthy.
Labor wants to limit the influence of billionaires on elections, while independents say that the road to public office doesn't come cheap.
I, like most Australians, think there's too much money in politics. But the other principle we need to balance is that people also want to know when they have a choice of candidate. And it's really difficult and expensive to get your name out there and get your message out there.
So is there a right way to fix political donations? Today, Guardian Australia's editor-in-chief Lenore Taylor and head of newsroom Mike Tischer on how much money is too much money in politics. It's Friday, the 22nd of March.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good morning, Lenore.
Morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Jane.
So, Lenore, this week, a number of independent MPs introduced the Fair and Transparent Elections Bill into both houses of parliament. But this bill has a long history, right? How did it all come about?
A long history, you could say that, like decades long. I think everyone involved in politics has known that our system for funding elections, and in particular the system of political donations, is ridiculous. It's been completely broken for a really long time. And there have been attempts in every parliament since I can remember to reform it. They failed effectively because there's such acute self-interest tied up in this matter for every political party involved. And really the problem is that for lots of reasons taken together, which I'm sure we'll get into, we don't know where political donations come from, or we don't know enough about where political donations come from. And if you don't know where donations come from, then it's very hard to figure out whether they're buying influence. And, you know, if you take one step back from that, do we really think that the biggest donors to political parties, which usually just happen to be industries that have a strong interest in not being regulated by the government. Do we really think they're the ones that have the biggest heartfelt interest in the democratic process and making democracy work? Or is something else going on here?
So what is currently wrong with the system that we have at the moment to protect against outsized influence from political donors, Lenore?
Well, you don't have to declare donations under $16,000, and you can make a bunch of donations under $16,000 and they're not added up and put against your name. You can buy wildly inflated priced tickets at fundraising dinners or join the business forums that the major parties have for a lot of money, where you get direct access to policymakers and sometimes even the Prime Minister or the opposition leader. There's a whole bunch of loopholes which taken together mean that even though we're supposed to know where donations come from, we don't actually know where about a quarter of the political donations come from. And that means we can't even begin to hold those donors and political parties to account or scrutinise who's donated what and what's happened to policy. We can't even see it. The ones we can see, we don't know about for a year or more.
Coming back to the most recent bill. How does this most recent bill try to address this huge problem?
So numerous ways. So they want to improve the reporting of donations. They want to lower the limit at which you have to report donations and reduce the ridiculous amount of time that you have to report a donation, to make it much closer to real-time reporting. They want to put a limit on single donations of $1.5 million. They want to bring in what's so-called truth in advertising, a difficult concept to legislate, but one that has been tried in states, particularly South Australia. They want to stop certain industries from donating, particularly gambling, alcohol, fossil fuels, tobacco companies, and interestingly, I think current and potential government contractors. That's been in the news a lot in the past few years. And most of these things are also, Labor have said, have been recommended by the committee that Labor set up and have been in Labor's policy. But what they don't want to do is put an overall cap on donations. And this is where we're in a slightly new situation where there's a whole new group of MPs in Parliament that we haven't seen before who benefited from large donations. They're not the usual suspects in that they're not neither of the two main political parties, but they've kind of thrown a new element in the mix because they received a large amount of donations from Climate 200 particularly.
And from three particular individuals, yeah. Like rich individuals. Yeah. But that's the interesting thing about it this time, right? Like normally these things fall over because Liberal and Labor cannot reconcile the differences in their self-interest. But now there's like a three-way self-interest fight going on, which seems to me to make it even harder. Like another thing that is in the independence bill, which both of the majors aren't going to like, is cracking down on the business networking things that the majors use to get money. So they have the two big parties allow businesses to buy sort of wildly inflated cost tickets to fundraising dinners or to become part of a business network where you get special briefings and networking dinners. And, you know, it's big money. Labor made $5 million from its business forum last year. It's like top access level. You can get tickets to an end of year party with the prime minister and that sort of thing. Now, the majors aren't going to like that. That is in the interests of the independents. But then on the other way, Labor's proposing to have a limit on what you can spend in an individual electorate. Now, that suits the major parties because they like to sort of cross-subsidise their entire campaign by getting public funding across every electorate, but then using the money from the electorates where they're not going to win in the electorates where they can win. It doesn't suit the Teals, who are just concentrating on a small number of electorates. So I think it's going to be a very complicated negotiation because there's at least three, well, if you put the Greens in, four sets of self-interest trying to kind of come to some sort of landing.
How do you think Labor will approach those negotiations, Lenore? Where do you think they sit at the moment?
Well, they've been negotiating for a long time. Like they went to the last election on a platform of changing these things. They promised real-time reporting of donations above $1,000, caps on big donations. They haven't done much publicly yet, but they have been negotiating behind the scenes. The Minister, Don Farrell, who's a very sort of canny factional player, has been leading those negotiations. They've recently sort of started briefing out that there's a bill coming. And I think that's sort of when the Teals and the Independents decided to sort of go on the offensive and put this bill into Parliament to kind of preempt what they knew was coming from Labor and set the agenda in a way that they thought was fair.
From the voters' point of view, I think there's kind of no, I think most voters probably, if they're asked, don't want huge donations from extremely wealthy individuals to influence policies, but they also don't want more public funding.
Which is the only other alternative.
Which is the only alternative. So there's no kind of obvious, you know, electoral gain for either party in this, except that Labor, you know, at the last election, the very election of the Teals was sort of founded in large part on their promise to do more about integrity in politics. And a lot of these measures that they put forward go very directly to that and would be welcome, I think, by a lot of the people who voted for them. But the sticking point is probably their insistence on not having an overall cap on donations, because it kind of chimes with rejection of the idea that very wealthy individuals should have an outsized say in our political system. So they're in a slightly awkward place as well, I think.
We could also point out that, you know, the gambling lobby is facing advertising regulation at the moment, and I'm sure it's a coincidence, giving very generously to the major parties as well. It's just a bit of a pattern when industries are facing regulation. They coincidentally develop a healthy regard for the future of democracy.
You know, transparency in political donations is a really important issue. So how difficult do you think it is for journalists or the media to sort of shine a light on where those donations are coming from if public disclosure can be avoided?
I mean, it's impossible to be fully across that because of the rules that Lenore just outlined, that you can't tell where all donations came from, as much as a quarter of all donations, and they're not reported for a long time after the election, by which time we regularly report on that, as others do, but the readers would look at that and say, well, you know, that's a long time ago. It's all that's in the past now. We know what happened at the election. We know what the outcome of the election was. Yes, it's interesting that those particular corporations or people gave money to certain political parties, but how much can you really do with that information? And when that amount of time has passed, it's kind of completely inadequate.
Even when the information is in real time, still really what we can do is line up, here's what this particular industry or person gave to a party, and oh look, here's the policy of the party. It's very difficult without leaks or something else to be able to prove causality between those two things. And that's just inherent in the reporting on these issues. So, you know, at the moment, we know that tobacco companies, both British American Tobacco and Philip Morris, have given donations to the National Party. And we know that the National Party is the one now arguing that vaping should not be completely banned, it should be regulated. I can tell you that those two things are true. I cannot assert causality between them because I have no proof of causality between them. So that is always the problem in reporting on these things, that, you know, you can just line up things and that gives our readers and our listeners good information. It doesn't actually prove that the donation caused the policy.
And so, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, Lenore, this debate about what to do about political donations has been going for many, many years now. Do you think reform is actually possible this time?
I'm always hopeful insofar as the major parties really, really hate having to go cap in hand to businesses to get money. Like, they don't like it. And, you know, the treasurers of the political parties for decades back have been telling us, we don't like this system. We don't like having to do this. We would prefer higher levels of public funding. So there is a self-interested argument. And also, because of scrutiny, the levels of corporate donations are declining. So there is a self-interest from all the political parties to try to get a handle on this. Also, there's the bigger issue of trust. And, you know, the political parties can see trust in the system declining, and these kinds of things are contributing to that. So there is a self-interest in trying to do something. And there has been for a long, long time, which is why there have been negotiations that have almost come to fruition in parliaments gone by. At the end of the day, though, the directors of the two parties look at it, and if they think that the changes to the system give an incremental advantage to their opponent over them, they're going to say no. You know, there was a point, I think it was just before the 2013 election, when Tony Abbott had actually agreed in writing to a set of reforms with Labor, and then had to overturn that because his own party room balked at it. So it's a issue of intense interest to the political parties. And to come to an agreement might involve taking a little bit of a risk that in some elements they might be disadvantaged or advantaged. You know, like it's that assessment of self-interest that usually stymies it in the end.
From Labor's point of view, I think there is the more recent impetus to this was Clive Palmer's intervention at the 2019 election when his company Mineralogy gave $83 million to the United Australia Party, but their ads were less devoted to getting United Australia Party candidates elected, which none of them were, and more to tearing down Bill Shorten, particularly.
It was an interference operation. Yeah.
And then at the last election, he gave even more, which resulted in the election of one senator. Was less explicitly directed at Labor, but Labor clearly see someone like that who has huge amounts of money at their disposal and is definitely not well inclined towards them as a direct electoral threat. So they referred to it very explicitly and at length in their you know, report on how their campaign failed in the 2019 election. So I think that's sort of given them a new focus on it, perhaps. And then the election of the Teals has brought this new element into it, which perhaps, even though they are, as Lenore said, there's kind of a three-way interest battle now, maybe there's a way where they where that new element brings something that to the debate that will at least get some of these measures across the line, because a lot of them people agree, well, at least a lot of them Labor can agree on with the crossbench, not all of them, but all the things about real-time disclosure and reducing the amount of amounts that need to be disclosed, they are not at odds on it.
But also public funding is problematic for the Teals, right? Because you get public funding is an amount of money per vote. If you're a major party and you run in every seat in the country, you don't put any resources into the safe seats held by your opponent that you know you're going to win, but you still get a proportion of votes there just because there's rusted on voters for you, the major party. And all that money then goes into winning the seats that you want. If you're the Teals and you're running in, you know, one seat or a few seats, then an increase in public funding actually proportionally disadvantages you compared with the majors. It's a way of entrenching the major parties and making it hard for the Teals and making it very hard for other new players to break into the system. So all of that has to be somehow balanced out. So everyone knows this is a problem and people have tried to fix it for a really long time. And in this parliament, there's been lots of stuff going on in the background trying to fix it. And the independents have sort of come in with an intervention to try to force this debate along in a way that might benefit them. And, you know, we're back to this situation of trying to negotiate something that we've failed to negotiate for many parliaments past. And maybe this time will be different. I don't know.
Next, hot bread and nasty swipes.
When our parents were our age, their lives looked a lot different than ours. You know, my parents owned a home and had two kids and a golden retriever by the time that they were 40. And my life just looked nothing like that.
Young Australians are the first generation to be worse off than our parents.
Home ownership is a distant dream.
We're the most educated generation, but drowning in debt.
Meanwhile, it's becoming harder and harder to find secure work.
And more often than not, we're told it's our fault.
But is it?
Who screwed millennials?
Not one person, not one place, not one bogeyman.
We're seeing a real shift in how we talk about economic instability and whose fault it is.
I'm Jane Lee.
And I'm Matilda Bosley. Find out who screwed millennials by subscribing to Full Story wherever you get your podcasts.
The series will be in your feeds from March 25th.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
And now we come to what we can't get out of our head. What was it for you this week, Lenore?
For me, it is the sudden emergence of this story about comments Donald Trump made about Kevin Rudd. They were made in an interview by Nigel Farage with Trump. He was interviewing Trump for GB News.
Now they've appointed Kevin Rudd, former Labour MP. I mean, he has said the most horrible things. You were a destructive president, a traitor to the West. And he's now Australia's ambassador in Washington.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Would you take a phone call from him?
He won't be there long if that's the case. I don't know much about him. I heard he was a little bit nasty. I hear he's not the brightest bulb. but I don't know much about him. But if he's at all hostile, he will not be there long.
Fair enough.
And what I'm interested in this story is the way that the sort of connections around the world have suddenly managed to ignite this story from almost nowhere. So according to 2GB this week, the former head of Sky News Australia, Angelo Frangopoulos, who now heads GB News, asked the current head of Sky News Australia, Boris Whittaker, to write the question for Nigel Farage to ask Trump. The question contained all the things that Kevin Rudd had said prior to becoming ambassador that were negative about Trump. It's quite possible to infer from his answer that he didn't actually know who Kevin Rudd was, but predictably, when faced with criticism of himself, Donald Trump lashed out against Kevin Rudd. And this is now being used by pretty much every News Corp columnist in the country, and it must be said by members of the coalition to say that Kevin Rudd shouldn't be the ambassador anymore. I just think it's an amazingly sort of circuitous route, and I'm sure has nothing to do with Kevin Rudd's work as the head of the Australians for a Murdoch Royal Commission.
Right. And Mike, what was it for you this week?
Mine's a bit more offbeat, but it's all about bread.
We like the bread.
I love bread. Like,
bread's good.
No one can disagree with bread.
The UK Guardian did a story this week looking at the difference between a sourdough loaf that costs £5, so about $10, versus a white ultra processed loaf of white sliced bread that costs 45p in the supermarket. And why?
That seems cheap. Do we have any bread that costs a buck?
It's really cheap. But it was just a really interesting, quite long look at how bread fashions have changed over time and why, and how it came to be that white bread is cheap, even though it's worse for you, and brown bread, which used to be the staple of working people, has now become the expensive fancy bread. Sourdough loaves, obviously dear to the heart of The Guardian generally, but it's about highly processed foods and how they can be made so cheap. Yeah, it's just things that are good for you have somehow become the most expensive things, even though they don't really need to be.
Thanks so much for your time, Mike.
Thanks, Jane.
And thank you, Lenore.
Thanks, Jane.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannon, James Milsom, and Miles Herbert. The executive producer was Miles Martignoni. Full Story will be back with you on Monday when our special new series, Who Screwed Millennials, finally launches. It's a 5-part series where my colleague Matilda Bosley and I set out to find all the reasons millennials are set to be the first generation worse off than our parents. It's a wild and fun ride, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Make sure you subscribe to Full Story so you don't miss the first episode, and leave us a rating or review to let us know what you think of it. Okay, I'm Jane Lee. Catch you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. 6 factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.